Dr. Condor has been a team neuropsychologist for the Carolina Hurricanes. He's co-founder of the Sports Concussion Program at St. David's School and co-author of the Sports Concussion Legislation for the state of North Carolina. Dr. Condor currently consults with many high schools and college teams and athletes throughout the lifespan. In addition to being board certified in both clinical neuropsychology and rehabilitation psychology, he is certified as an EMT. Pre-conference attendees will especially benefit from his expertise in assessment and rehabilitation, particularly with respect to refractory sports concussion syndrome. He is a very prominent speaker, as you will soon hear if you haven't heard him speak before, and has conducted numerous lectures at regional and national conferences in addition to webinars. So we're really grateful to have his expertise, and he's also a charter member of SNS, a founding member. So Dr. Condor, welcome, and thank you again for agreeing to speak with us. We're focusing here on sports neurological assessment and the role of the sports neuropsychologist.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ott. And it's really hard to follow Dr. Rush and Dr. Vargas here because they've done such a great job. And I feel really humbled to be here. I guess you don't have the slides, which is good because I've edited them severely and they're still, you know, this morning was working on them. So the problem is I've done much longer presentations and I've had to cut a lot of stuff down. And I'm going to probably try to have to go through some as others have. But basically, there's a core. We're going to talk a little bit about a concussion, talk about assessment, return to learn, and then some novel interventions. Because what I do now is really a lot of intervention and treatment of refractory post-concussive syndrome. I want to start back and just say I've been doing this for a while. I was very humbled 22 years ago that Dean Smith was one of the first college coaches to recognize the seriousness of a sports concussion, not on the football field, but on the basketball court. In the 94 playoffs, we'd won the NCAA championship in 93. Derek Phelps was doing the layup. He was clipped. He was like 6 feet off the ground. He's a great point guard. He was clipped by a Boston College player. Came down, hit his head on the hardwood, and got a concussion. And the BC coach later said, hey, there, no big deal. He didn't even go to the training room, and we got knocked out in the second round of the playoffs. And it offended me as a neuropsychologist and also as an alum and a UNC supporter. So I wrote a letter to Coach Smith who took it. And within a matter of weeks, that got changed into that sort of hit on the basketball court got changed into an intentional foul. So that's what happens when you have an icon like Coach Smith, who unfortunately passed away last year. Let's talk about some few. Can you hear me okay with this here? So, okay. What in the world is a sports neuropsychologist? Oh, my God, we don't need another subspecialty. But basically, we're applying clinical neuropsychology to a traumatic brain injury obtained through recreational and sports activities. It's very similar to mild TBI. I see Dr. Levin here, who's an expert, you know, icon in the field of mild TBI. It's similar, but it's different because of the population we're working with. We're working with athletes, so there's the sports psychology part that I really appreciate, and you really, to me, have to know the individual group psychology of athletes, especially serious athletes, to see how they react to a concussion versus, say, a personal injury litigant. We have a definition of this. It's on our website. I helped craft that. It was really a group effort, so you can go to the website and find that. I'm not going to go over a lot of this. A lot of this is from Zurich, and I think you'll have the slides after, but the International Sports Concussion Conference defining this. But I like this conceptualization from Dr. McCrory that puts sports concussion in the mild to minimal component of the range of severity of TBI. I began my career working with severe and very severe persistent vegetative state traumatic brain injuries way back 30 years ago. And back then, we sort of, I don't know about the sports stuff, but there's been such a great evolution. So 20 years ago, I was writing Coach Smith and saying, this is really bad. 30 years ago, I was going, no, I was working with athletes. One of my first athletes was a rugby player at University of Richmond when I was at Medical College of Virginia. Had a high quad injury and was ventilator dependent. That was a serious sports injury. Aspects of a concussion, there are a lot of ways to slice the pie. I think as neuropsychologists, how many of you are neuropsychologists in here, if you can raise your hand? Okay, so majority here. I'm sort of preaching to the choir. Basically, we're gonna look at four or five, neurocognitive and psychological. Some of you may just be comfortable in working at the neurocognitive level, concentration, memory, sustained concentration, auditory working memory, executive functioning. But I also like the psychological component because that seems to go along with the prolonged PCS. And the question is it just purely a mental event or is it a physical event? The old days we were trained, is this organic or is this functional? And we're sort of coming back to that, even in DSM-5 a little bit. And I still like that dichotomy, even though it's false. So some of the psychological events can be driven by a concussion, which causes a deficit in neurotransmitter modulation. This one I like in terms of the sports psychology point of view is Kroll's pyramid of sports performance. If you look at the bottom and entrance, there are like 45 million kids, and when I say kids, K through 12, and most of us will be working with K through 12 athletes. I really enjoyed my time with the National Hockey League and working with elite athletes who were nationally, if not internationally, ranked, and some who were Olympians, a very great athlete. But most of the folks are going to start in this entrance level, and as time goes on, the pyramid, of course, gets smaller for a couple of reasons. Some may lose interest. You know, mom or dad may, or dad say, hey, I want you to be, the next Peyton Manning. They may go on to other things. There may be problems that they're more susceptible to injury, ACL, MCL tears, concussions. So as you get to the top of the pyramid, there's a resilience, maybe physical and psychological, so that you can get to that elite level of performance, but you're not invulnerable. We see the best, Dr. Rice, you see him at UVA, great athletes, even though we got to play in the ACC championship with UNC, great athletes there, and even in the Olympians, no one is invulnerable to a concussion. There's not a Superman out there who can take a hit and be body checked or boarded and not come out sometimes with a concussion. This is very useful because the seriousness of an athlete doesn't have to do with the level of play. We see very serious four-year-old hockey players who say, hey, I want to play in the NHL, or Pop Warner football players who say, hey, I want to be the next Peyton Manning, or I'd use some other examples, but we don't particularly like the Patriots around our area. Now, in terms of teams, interdisciplinary is very different than multidisciplinary. They're used interchangeable, but they're not. My fellowship was in physical, the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, commonly known as rehab medicine, and we work in an interdisciplinary team. The thing that's unique about that and wonderful is we're really driven by the needs of the patient. Multidisciplinary tends to be hierarchical, not a lot of integration. Interdisciplinary, who's got the best skills to help this patient right now, whether it's speech, OT, rec therapy, nursing, neuropsychology, psychology. And we get together and put our expertise together to meet the needs of the patient in an inpatient setting or athlete. What are the unique, brag on us here, what are the unique contributions of psychology? Well, we got a lot of academic coursework in intellectual and cognitive assessments, statistics, research, design, and test and measurements, and hundreds of hours in supervision of administration and interpretation of tests. Tests are our business. That's really in the evolution of psychology as an independent discipline back during World War II. It was tests and measurements that brought us out of the lab into clinical psychology. A little bit of this, you all know this, you've heard about the 7 to 10 days. This is a slide from David Hovde, let me use, that shows the metabolic crisis and the mismatch between regional cerebral blood flow and glucose metabolism. That's basically what's going on. So a concussion basically is a biologic process and not a pathophysiologic process. It's not damage to the brain parenchyma as much as we can understand it. There's usually four domains we look at, and you can slice the pie different ways between Dr. Rice and Dr. Vargas. These are the primary four that you'll see: physical, cognitive, emotional, and sleep. The post-concussive symptom checklist, pick these up all the time, usually on the checklist. 22 items on a 0 to 6 point Likert scale. The ones bolded are the most common, and headache. But the neurologists right now, we're in a large neuroscience practice, which has 30 neurologists, fourth largest neurology practice in the U.S., including four pediatric neurologists and a developmental pediatrician and two neurosurgeons. And so headaches are the bread and butter of neurology, and Dr. Vargas will tell you that. And then also they're really the bane of post-concussive syndrome. Typical deficits that you'll see, problems with working memory, especially auditory working memory, visual and verbal memory, reduce executive abilities, slow to reaction time and emotional ability. And sort of the scope of the problem, here we're going back to this data, and this is data published by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. The MMWR is the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Review, a very fun thing to read, but very useful. And here they cite 45 million kids in sports. Here's the 3.8 estimated concussions, maybe 300K organized sports concussions. Sports, and here's my soapbox. Sports provide physical, intellectual, and social development. A friend of mine, they were gonna start charging for varsity football in North Carolina. A friend of mine is a forensic psychologist, said, "Oh my God, we're gonna have to build more prisons." Now that's both a sarcastic and a scary sort of comment. But basically, it provides that. But there's a pushback, and you may see this now. There's really fear in a lot of parents. Hey, my kid's going to get, my 6-year-old, my 8-year-old, my 10-year-old is going to get CTE, or sometimes athletes say that. There is a pushback against sports, and one of my biases is I like football. My dad played football for Army in World War II. His brother was a starting quarterback at University of South Carolina. I was a lousy football player. Our son was defensive captain, 4 years of varsity football. I like football. It's my favorite sport. What I'm concerned about more is EDD, not erectile dysfunction, exercise deficiency disorder versus ADD, because you've got, 66% of the people over age 20 are overweight, 34% are obese, and 25% of kids 2 to 19 are overweight. What happens? Those overweight become obese in early adulthood, then they develop metabolic syndrome in middle age, endocrine dysfunction, diabetes, cardiac dysfunction. They're precursors of early dementia in your 60s. How do you work with this? Put exercise programs and physical therapy back in the school. Sorry, that's my soapbox. And then this is, the cause of injuries. Below age 15, the two most common causes of traumatic brain injuries shown in emergency departments are playground accidents and bicycle accidents. Okay, what are we finding? Dr. Vargas talked about the fancy neuroimaging stuff. And I asked the question, what can we find greater than 7 to 10 days on neuropsychological testing or balance testing with the BESS or the scatter or the SAC? You're finding the quantitative EEGs. This may seem funky, but it's a study that Mike McRae and Bill Bard did. They did baseline non-injury EEGs and then worked with high school athletes afterwards and found EEG abnormalities up to 45 days, and Dr. McRae, who'll speak tomorrow, the keynote speaker, wonderful researcher, said, there were still problems, it's just the group data washed them out. Evoked potentials, event-related potentials, another electrophysiologic measure, are showing anomalies in the P300 wave up to a year. Steve Broglio at Michigan has published on that. The P3 wave basically is a positive wave that should occur 300 milliseconds after exposure to a stimuli, and it's associated, the P3B, with posterior functioning in the temporal parietal area is mediated by norepinephrine, and it has to do with working memory as opposed to the A, which is frontal and dopaminergic. It's sort of a biomarker. I like that because in my office, and we were as a large practice, there's 7 of us, I have a neuroelectrophysiology laboratory where I can hook up brains and look at this neuroelectrical functioning, and I don't have to have an MRI scanner to do it. PET scanner shows problems, and it's not that they stop after 2 weeks, it's just the study stopped after 2 weeks. The magnetoencephalography shows problems. fMRI, this is a study Mike McRae did. Initially, hypoactivation at 13 hours, and then 7 weeks hyperactivation in the right attentional frontal attentional networks, and then the Art Mailender's work with the DTI studies of Ivy League athletes. So the 2013 Institute of Medicine said, there's all this stuff out there, but sort of it's just experimental. But there's a lot of stuff out there, and it's troubling to me as not just a neuropsychologist, but a neuroscientist and a parent. I've got friends, and I work with high school athletes. So the summary of the evidence, and this is from Grant Iverson, the consummate researcher's researcher, and Dr. McRae. Iverson, Grant now is at Harvard, Mike McRae Medical College of Wisconsin. There are changes in cognition, physical functioning, and balance. The greatest changes are immediate. They normalize 1 to 3 weeks. 90% of university athletes recover in 2 weeks, and then the high school athletes, 90% in a month. Multiple concussion, 3 or more, you've got an increased risk for future concussion, slower recovery, greater risk for long-term problems. Most repeat concussions happen in 7 to 10 days, 75% to 92%. So Lindsay Nelson and Michael McRae are just, you know, excellent researchers, published a lot of work, are postulating this physiological vulnerability that happens after that 7 to 10 day window when you're not really finding anything on typical tests. But some of this experimental data that I just showed you, the ERPs, fMRI, DTI, magnetoencephalography, is showing a vulnerability that may be going on. All right, assessment. Sports concussion is so different because it doesn't fit traditional models. It's disabling, it requires immediate attention, there's a functional impact on learning behavior, and it's not static. How do you hit a moving target? Now, Dr. Resch talked about baseline testing, and we advocate that, and the National Hockey League model is baseline testing. And what we did last year, and I think we're still doing it this year, but I'm not involved this year, using an iPad model of the SCAT-3, it's called the X2. And the cool thing about that is that you can test somebody in Raleigh and they're playing in Vancouver and you wondered about an injury and you just pull up the iPad and redo the data. The iPad is not used as a measurement device except for finger to nose. You've got dots moving around the screen, you know, the old drunk driving test. And everything else is just data recording. So it could be a different trainer, it could be other team's trainer in Vancouver or Boston or wherever. It's just really cool, and I like that as implementation of technology. And then sideline stuff, and for a while I did sideline stuff with our high school football. It's just great. Friday night football, that doesn't get any better than that, being right there on the sideline. And what happens sometimes, I call it, you know, this is sort of goofy, but I call it doing the drunk driving eval, because it's the same sort of stuff. You had the player over, pulling them away, they're pumped up, they're really excited, and doing some balance testing, finger to nose, finger to thumb. Sometimes ask the trainer, and I can't speak highly enough of athletic trainers. They're the frontline people. They're protecting your kids out there. They know your kids integrally, and with ours, the one at St. David's, Shannon Newton, she has a master's degree in athletic training, but she's also a captain in the Army National Guard, and she's really kicking those kids' butts in Army training. But she knows him, says, oh, he's goofy like that all the time. This isn't a concussion, or his balance is off. And then sometimes asking mom, I don't have time to go into one about a mom noticed her son catching passes differently. He was a great athlete, we were losing. He got hammered, didn't want to tell anybody, actually lost sight in one eye. So he still was catching passes, but mom said he's catching them differently. And I tested him at the end of the game. I said, why didn't you tell anybody? He said, well, look, I'm the best player on the team. We were losing. You needed me out there. So talking about denial. And he said, but my vision came back. And, you know, what's the deal? Don't bother the coach. When I started doing this, first thing coach said to me was, you're not going to tell me how to coach, are you? No, sir. That's your domain. But I'm going to talk to you about safety. Let's talk about computers, because there's a proliferation of computer testing now. And there are advantages and disadvantages. Advantages, you know, you got 100 football players or 60 hockey players. It's hard to do individual testing. We did that with the SCAT-3 on the iPad, which is pretty easy. But in terms of a face-to-face battery, that would take forever. And good thing, standardized administration of stimuli, time and cost efficient, sensitivity within milliseconds. Some of you remember in the old days, we used a stopwatch, an old-fashioned analog stopwatch, and that was the accuracy as opposed to computer timing now. The disadvantages, and one of the things most people don't talk about, hardware problems. Computers are not perfect measurement instruments, and if you talk to, you know, at one point I had a computer program out, I was just talking to my former co-founder of the program and programmer yesterday. Keyboards are different, mice are different, processing speeds are different, RAM is different. You've got all these hardware issues, and if you're looking at, you know, thousands of a second, you may have a really cheap keyboard or a mouse, or you're using a wireless mouse, or you're hooked up to a server in Pittsburgh or Australia over a Wi-Fi in your office or in the arena, that's not great. So there are all these hardware issues that really have to be considered. The TOVA people, I'm not trying to brag on them, what they do, they have an external input device. thing you hold in your hand, you click it, and when you boot their program up, it knocks Windows out and goes right to DOS, a good old-fashioned DOS. So it gets around a lot of this timing and buffering issues that are there. There's a lack of human oversight. There are limited domains. You know, basically with computers, there's no auditory output to the patient and no verbal input or to the athlete. And then problems with psychometrics, and I'll talk about that ad nauseum. They seem overly valid, and they're subject to abuse. You know, a person or a parent gets a printout, and it's a really pretty, you know, nice graphic, multicolor printout, and they'll say, oh my gosh, Johnny is just hammered. I'll never let him play football again in his life, or Johnny's fine. Here's some of the other concerns. There's a financial burden. I think Dr. Rice put up the cost of doing this, and you have to have money to do it. And there's a cost of training and expertise and time in terms of baselining a large school. At St. David's, is where the English model, we try to get most of the kids to play sports as part of the academic program. There's an argument from some, it doesn't reduce concussions. It's insensitive to poor performance. Of course, you saw Peyton Manning, who went on ESPN Sports Center and said, yeah, I sandbagged all that because I didn't want to get pulled out of the game when I got hammered. Again, overly face valid because of the graphics, and problems with test, retest reliability. I'm not anti-computer. I like computers. I like technology. It's got to get better. The problem is there are multiple papers coming out that show problems with test, retest reliability. There's Wesley Cole. Let's take the military, because they don't have a dog in the fight for sports at Fort Bragg, and the athletes are very, military is very much, especially Fort Bragg, like athletes, looking at multiple computerized neurocognitive tests. There's the Broglio research, Lindsay Nelson and others with multiple NCAA schools are reporting very poor test-for-test reliability, depending on the test, when it was done, the age, the amount of time between the baseline and the retesting and intervals and how many intervals. And some have even say, from the Broglio, the Michigan group says, these are below optimal standards for clinical use. So what's the problem here? Well, if you remember psychometrics, what we're looking for is test-for-test reliability, basic thing. And and sports testing has really maxed out psychometrics because nobody's had to look at this as hard as the test retest rather than, hey, you test somebody 3 years later, you do another testing to meet standards for qualification for learning disability. So you think about this, we're looking at test retest reliability, and you start with the standard error difference, and the formula for that is the square root of the squared sum of the standard error is a measurement of testing 1 plus testing 2. And the formula for the standard error measurement is the standard deviation times the square root of 1 minus reliability coefficient. So if you got a low reliability coefficient, you've got a large standard error measure, you square that, you add it to 2, you take the standard deviation, and you've got this band of error, this humongous. The problem with most of the printouts, people see a number and say, they think, oh, that's a real score. We know that's an estimated true score, and the score exist in this band of error. It's called a confidence interval, and it depends on whether you're using the 90th or 95th percentile confidence interval. So some of the last one from the Michigan group just came out, was published in Sports Medicine this month online, saying, well, you need to take into account the reliability statistics of the instrument that you're using. And I don't think most people do that or could cite you the reliability statistics when they're using any of the computer programs. I'm not being critical of impact per se, it's the most research. It's the most often used in sports, and it's the most research. And then sometimes there's a modest increase in terms of incremental validity over a symptom checklist, and then limited construct specificity. Impact now has 4 domains, Art Mailander, and Phil Schatz of our group, Art was at Dartmouth, now he's at Nebraska, right there next to the field. Phil's at St. Joe's. They did a factor analysis and found a 2-factor solution in terms of memory and speed that actually increased the reliability and efficacy of that. Think of it this way, you have a verbal memory test on a computer, and basically what you're looking at is visual processing of words with images. It goes in, you know, Area 17, the Calcarine Fissure, then over to Wernicke's a little bit, so it's not auditory. pencil and paper stuff. Jeff Barth at UVA started it probably in the 80s with his SLAM, sideline laboratory assessment model, from Jeff's interest in looking at mild TBI. And then Ruben Achimendia at Penn State really came up with a full battery, he and Mars Patukian, in terms of the Penn State concussion model about 20 years ago. A variant of that model is now used in the NHL and NFL. And the domains that we're looking at really are attention and concentration, working memory, learning, memory, executive functioning, processing speed, and the concussion checklist. For the model, some people say, well, let's go from, you know, a computer program to a full neuropsych, and that's really overkill, because the problem is that you really shouldn't do a neuropsych or a psychoed until a problem is chronic, and by definition for schools, it lasts 6 months, and then you need to go to 504 IEP. The concussion evaluation helps with treatment, and to me, it can be a hybrid model of both computer and pencil and paper, because they're different. The computer, again, doesn't measure some of the computer stuff. The pencil and paper doesn't measure them either. So there are problems with pencil and paper, practice effects, and it's not just content, there's the form. And once you've had a word list, you know what a word list is, or you've had a digit span, you know that you'll do better. The reliability measures, some of the reliability of the pencil and paper tests is pretty bad also. You know, the reliability of Trails B, depending on the study, is like 0.3 to 0.5. That is, how likely are you to get it again? Now, the other problem I didn't mention with retest, is that we're not testing a static phenomenon. They're athletes, and hopefully they're getting better, so that adds to the variance. So it'll lower the reliability on the second retesting. And then a lack of equivalence. The Hopkins Verbal Learning Test has 5 forms, but there's no equivalence studies for them. And then here's a suggested brief assessment. You'll get this. If not, I'm going to brag a little bit. Last couple of years, we published 5 papers, 2 empirical, and 1 has this in terms of the brief assessment of what we're looking at for these domains. And I like digits forwards and backwards. It doesn't really help a lot, but it's a good warm-up. And then it's got a built-in internal validity scale with a reliable digit span. I still like it, even though the studies say it doesn't help a lot. Brief test of attention, the Penn State cancellation, and we use this the old-fashioned DOS-CPT that's not sold anymore. You have to go with probably TOVA, which I like, but it's a per use and it's more expensive, or IVA. And then this is basically is the National Hockey League battery, except we add paragraph memory because basically we're working with students K through 12. And we want to see what happens when they're in a classroom and a teacher's talking like I am, and how many bits in that paragraph can they remember? Are they spacing out or distorting it or whatever? And I'm going to go down to the psychological part. It was a wonderful study that just came out using the brief symptom inventory, looking at pre-injury somatization and prolonged post-concussive syndrome symptoms. I like the profile of mood states, and I like some of the specific athletic tests. The athletic coping skills inventory is really very good, but I really like the sports inventory for pain. Mike Myers, who's at both Montana State and Idaho State right now as a kinesiologist, came up with this with the idea, you know, sport, we're going to get hurt. How are people going to handle pain? It means a lot about them. And how are they going to work with medical treatment? So it's a 15, the shorter version, 15 item one. But I really like that one. And then for symptom validity, again, the reliable digit span, the Ray 15 item. I'm of the bias that most athletes are going to perform well, as opposed to personal injury litigants who are going for whatever reason to perform poorly. So you don't need to do a humongous symptom validity battery like the word memory test or the medical symptom validity test, Paul Green's work. I liked our old test, CARB. It was a computerized assessment response bias. Right now it's in hiatus because it's a small shop. Basically, a friend of mine still runs the business, and he has not been able to integrate it with Windows 10 and some of the updates. I think that's still used, I think, at Penn and UVA. I'm not sure if you use CARB anymore, but it's been used in some of the studies. And then this is for little kids. My wife is a pediatric neuropsychologist. I'm sorry this is so tiny, But she works with kids as young as 4 or even younger with sports concussions, and has tried to work out a good pencil and paper battery, because there really aren't any, you know, really aren't any good computer tests for kids that young. There are a lot of problems with that. So reliable change, we've already, how am I doing for time? Okay, so reliable change, again, what you're looking for here is this performance better or worse than practice effects added to the inherent unreliability or reliability of the test? So here's where you get this formula, the means of the test by the standard error difference, which is the square root of the standard errors of measurements, or the sum of the standard error measurements squared. So the reliable change, and the reliable change with practice, say you take a person who's not injured, give them a test time one, come back 15 days later, and you get an estimate of practice. But then you want to take an injured person, which is adding some unreliability to that. But basically, they have to exceed that. You multiply that by 1.96, and you get the 95th confidence interval. So this is really very important. And again, you know, when you were testing somebody one time 3 years later for a school setting, you really didn't have to worry about that. But you're doing testing a couple times within maybe a couple of weeks. There are a lot of these issues that need to be addressed. Okay, prolonged recovery. This is from Zurich. Everybody should know this. These are all risk factors. We like to look at this biopsychosocial model and ask the question, because this really is what's going on in a concussion. What's the biology? You know, maybe out of our domain, this is medicine's domain, and medicine may say, yeah, they've got migraine, there's a family history of migraine. I guess because I work in a large neurology practice and hear people talk migraine all day, and migraine's the bread and butter of neurology that we're working with that, especially our head pediatric neurologist, John Wooten, who was also an Air Force physician, a high school quarterback, star, and I think he's got, you know, extraterrestrial sense for migraines. But basically, that early premorbid medical and psychological history of the family, and then the individual psychology characteristics. What's between somebody's ear? Are they resilient? Do they have flexibility? Do they have resources? Are they rigid, neurotic, you know, not really easy to get along with? They can't take stress. Sorry, I'm giving some of my biases out here. What are the pain, again, going back to the Mike Myers Sports Inventory for Pain, what are the pain coping abilities? It could be just people biologically and psychologically have different pain coping tolerances. What are the family dynamics? There was one kid my wife worked with, and she couldn't figure it out. He did fine on all the tests. He looked good. Everything was fine. But he kept saying, I can't think. I can't remember. I'm having these horrible problems. And finally, she just sat down, and they just sort of brainstormed. And what came out was the kid said, look, if I get better, my parents are going to get a divorce, and I don't want them to get a divorce. So it's even stuff like that you've got to consider. And then in the non-sports, possibility of secondary gain. There's not so much with that, although there is litigation. I was contacted by someone about a sports lawsuit yesterday, being an expert witness. But basically, you want to look at possibility of secondary gain in some aspect. So it's everything that you would do for a really good neuropsychological evaluation, but expanded. And again, looking at this biopsychosocial model that basically, you know, goes from the subatomic to the cosmic, if you will. Okay, return to learn. Again, you're probably going to be working with K-12, and most of the kids, you know, even if they're not playing, will need to go back to the classroom. St. David's is a college prep school, got a lot of AP kids there, a lot of really type A kids that want to do well on everything. And they want to get in the classroom, but their brains aren't working. They can't, they can't do calculus or AP Chem or bio real well. So we try to work and titrate the academic aspects to help them get better. Because you know, if you're in a sort of an AP curriculum and you're out of class for a couple of days, you're really going to get behind. And these are the typical things that you see. And this is a slide my wife came up with. She, again, pediatric neuropsychologist. We call her the concussion queen. She'll do sometimes 3 or 4 concussion evals a day. She consults with our school system, largest school system in the state, and also has come up with a program that's been adopted by our state's Department of Public Instruction and is presented at the Gefeller System. On the left are problems, on the right are solutions, very pragmatic. And you'll get a copy of this. If not, email me and I'll get you a copy of it. And then the idea of after a concussion, you don't need a 504 IP. Usually there's an emergency medical plan that can be implemented within a couple of days for academic modifications with a note from the physician or the neuropsychologist. It's very flexible, it's adaptable. You know, the IEP may take 2 or 3 weeks or even a month to even get scheduled. And this is really dear to my heart here because, you know, our son, as I said, was a varsity athlete. And that's him right there in the middle, little guy number 11 in white. You know, people always say, you're a neuropsychologist, you let your son play football? Well, yeah, my dad played football. I was a lousy football player. And we did it, but we wanted to do it straight, as safely. So we came up with a comprehensive program. Now, this is an away game. Eastern North Carolina, probably a lot like East Texas. You drive your pickup truck right up to the sidelines, have a good old time, you know, tailgating out there. So we came up with this program. Let's do it. We got the headmaster on board. The chairman of the board was a personal injury attorney. And when I said, Joe, you know, you've got a real liability here if you don't have a good sports concussion. And this was before the Gefeller Law that we wrote with Kevin Guskowitz and Josh Bloom. And so we got the chairman of the board on board, and we basically wanted to look at everybody. At first, it was just athletics. We realized some of the teachers, especially in a prep school, are a little resentful of some of the athletes. Well, they're getting special treatment, and they're not going to, you know, they're not going to go to a Ivy League school. So we went through and we have education, and the education is for everybody. We talked to the coaches, we had players and parents meeting, and one of the things we found, the parents couldn't come in for the meetings, so we did a YouTube video. If you Google St. David's concussion, you'll find the NAN, N-A-T-A concussion video being sandwiched between specific to St. David's. We talked about prevention a lot because I believe with education there's prevention, and one of the prevention was talking to peers. You know, to say to kids, hey, you know, you're not narking on your friend if you think they got a concussion and the trainer or nobody noticed. You're really helping them, and if anything else, you're helping your team win, because if somebody's really concussed, they really can't play very well. And also working with weight training and best practices. You know, when I worked with the NHL, the Finns and the Swedes were big people for neck bridges. Get that neck strong, you won't get concussions as much. There's not a lot of data to that, but it makes sense. Your head is an 8-pound bowling ball and a lollipop stick, according to the personal injury attorneys, and think about that. You get those good sternocleidomastoids and cervical muscles, it may help. And then the management. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the funky stuff I'm doing with intervention, because a lot of what I'm doing now is working with refractory post-concussive syndrome using psychophysiologic models. Of course, education, there's evidence-based, just education using the CDC handouts works. Pragmatic behavioral management, do this, don't do that. Modified cognitive behavior therapy for sports. Okay, you're not playing your sport now, it's not the end of the world, you're not gonna become a couch potato, you're not gonna get a chance to go to a Div 1 or Div 2 school. And then insomnia, is a big issue with insomnia for maybe 6 months. Was the latest tweet. I'm not really high techy, but I get tweets from the American Academy of Neurology. They're some of the best tweets out there, and that way you don't have to read the journal articles because I've got a short attention span, or you can read the abstract. So insomnia for 8 months, and sometimes folks don't like the medicine. They may need them. They don't like the medicines. The medicines work for a primary problem but have a secondary side effect. And cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is really a primary treatment, even for the sleep neurologist down the hall, right down from my hall, is a sleep lab. CBTI is what it's called. All of these are trying to create a sense of self-efficacy. A lot of times after an injury, an athlete may say, I'm out of control, I have no regulation, I can't do anything, or anybody, whether an athlete or not, and trying to give them the sense that here's something you can do yourself, not a medicine you take, and I'm not being negative in medicine because they really need it, especially the migraines. Here's something you can do that can help that medicine, whether it's a migraine medicine or even a psychostimulant. There's the typical sort of, you know, temperature and EMG stuff. what we've done is to work a lot with heart rate variability. John Letty, I really enjoy his stuff, and he must like me because he's citing my articles and his articles, has done a lot looking at autonomic nervous system, not just CNS correlates of concussion, but autonomic nervous system and cardiac correlates. There's reduced heart rate variability. Your heart rate, your rate is not a metronome. It should be variability, which goes along with greater cardiac health. After a concussion, the variability is reduced, and the cerebral perfusion is reduced. And it's very easily measured. I use equipment from Thought Technology in Montreal, really nice research-grade equipment in the lab, and can measure this with a photoplethysmogram and a respiration belt. And the goal is to increase this balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic. You know, sympathetic, fight or flight, parasympathetic, rest and digest, which I sort of like a little better. But you want to balance because you want to have the flexibility to meet the needs of the environment for what you want to do, whether it's playing sports, talking at a conference, taking an exam, or whatever. And then here's one of my best cases. I'm not showing you my failures. This was a marathon runner with a really weird slip and fall. This guy was getting a PhD in immunology, microbiology, and the scary thing was his research was on a low level Ebola virus, and he was in a biohaz facility wearing a completely self-contained respirator suit, and he couldn't do the computer. He was doing his dissertation pencil and paper when I started with him, and because he'd been such a good marathoner, by getting synchrony between his heart rate, if you can see this, his heart rate in sort of the pinkish and his respiration in blue, almost superimposed curves. We increase cerebral perfusion over a 20-minute session, increase the low frequency cardiac status over the very low frequency to sympathetic and the vagal-driven stuff. And Jack Ginsburg at the Columbia, South Carolina VA was doing a research series on heart rate variability and post-traumatic stress disorder because it's used for that. And he said, hey, you do concussions. Why don't you see if there's anything out there? And I went, I don't know. It sounds interesting. I don't know anything about it. So my wife and I looked at all the research, found some empirical data, wrote an article that was published in this study. And it's so weird when you do online stuff. This is a very reputable online journal. You can go in and look, and as earlier this month, been out a year and a half, we've had over 5,200 hits on all continents but Antarctica. And I'm really frustrated because nobody in Antarctica is reading my damn article. And the cool thing is you can click on this and almost go down to a Google Street level of where the people live. It's a little spooky because a lot of people in China and Iran are reading this, and I'm getting really interesting emails. How do we implement this? And a recent one from Iceland, hey, I work at a rehab facility in Iceland, and we want to do this, what kind of equipment and stuff like this. So this is sort of ego gratifying, but it's also cool. And then the EEG stuff, which really is sort of high tech. This was a world-class hockey player after a concussion. And the interesting thing is there's no alpha blocking with eyes open and eyes closed. And Dr. Vargas may know that better and be able to explain that. And this is, you know, how it looks. It's just an EMG headband with sensors on the traps. Traps are really important muscles, say, for golf. If you've got a problem with that, and then a EEG headband. Cranial electrical stimulation may sound really far out. The VA has bought boatloads of these. It's basically microcurrent. Put clips on each earlobe and run current through the brainstem, and you increase neurotransmitter production. And then the exercise part. One of the things I tell people now is, because they're so scared, hey, the brain is resilient. Aaron Bickler, who was supervising me on my internship in Austin, was talking about how the brain really can withstand a certain degree of force. There's an evolutionary survival function to it. It can take deformation and stretching. Kevin Guskowitz and Jason Mihalik did studies looking at G-forces. There's no one G-force. There's a range of vulnerability to produce a concussion. Some people will have a concussion at 60 Gs, and these are, you know, UNC football players, and some will take 140 Gs. So if you're not a neuropsychologist, think about neuropsychology, especially people aren't getting better if they've got these neurologic vulnerabilities. My wife sees a lot of kids, preemies, that are really affected by it. Migraines, family history, and stuff like that. These are good resources. And conclusion, concussions, as you heard, multi-system, you need a multimodal, multi-team assessment. And I'm sorry, I had to put this in. This is the beginning of my football career, Christmas 1952. This is a Charlie Justice football uniform. Most of you may not know. Charlie Tutu Justice, famous running back, Heisman candidate, North Carolina, went on and played for the Redskins. So again, I said my dad played football for Army during World War II. His brother played starting quarterback. So when you're 2 years old and you're told you're going to be the next Charlie Justice, it sort of backfired. I became more of a geek than a football player. But anyway, thank you for listening to this.